Welcome to The Inner Game. I'm Gwen Garcelon, your host. Thanks for listening. The inner game is the relationship we have to our authentic purpose and contribution in life. It's about the ways that we grow personally and spiritually on the inside that affects everything on the outside of our lives. The quality of our inner game is becoming increasingly important because we now know that our quantum world shifts to reflect whatever is inside us. Each of our contributions is critical to the quality of what is possible for all of us on the planet. So these are conversations with people who are up to something evolutionary in their lives and an opportunity to hear about how these people take on their spiritual and personal growth and how that strengthens their organizations and businesses to make a bigger difference. Our guest today is Brad Jarvis, the founder of Inner Activist, a program based in British Columbia that prepares change makers to meet the challenges of our world. As the program's vision states, these are leaders capable of creating, quote, a world where individual and collective leadership is based on justice and sustainability for all, communities, and the earth. Leadership that is self-aware, compassionate, collaborative, courageous, empowered, and accountable. I love that. Thank you so much for joining me, Brad.
You're so welcome, Gwen.
So your family history is quite a story, beginning during the rise of, well, not beginning, but what we're going to be talking about, you know, beginning during the rise of the Third Reich in Europe. Your family of Jewish origin moved several times, eventually settling in Canada. Tell us a little bit about how you came to understand that even though you didn't personally experience the trauma of that time, that you held the deep wounds of your family members' trauma. How did you come to kind of understand that?
Sure. I'm happy to do that. Just before we go any further, I just would like also to add that the Inner Activist is a project of Tides Canada. They actually are the charitable umbrella under which we operate. And also just to say that I'm speaking only on my own behalf, both regarding my history, not on behalf of my family. And I'm also not speaking on behalf of the project as a whole. I'm just speaking on my own behalf as one of the people involved.
Beautiful.
Just so we're just really clear about that. In a sense, my mother's family's history was the sort of elephant in the room. It was something that was almost never talked about. Even when it was talked about very briefly, very matter-of-factly, without any revelation of the emotions that that event had stirred in the lives of my grandparents' generation and my mom's generation. And so that helped to make it difficult for me to really be aware of the emotional or energetic or spiritual kind of legacy, if you wish,
right,
from that part of my family's history.
So it was something that you had to kind of almost stumble upon yourself through your own, you know, desire to finally grow and heal.
That's right. That's right. It was not foreground at all for me, even with the benefit of receiving counseling and initially through my work in personal growth workshops. It still remained quite carefully hidden. The story I'd been told was, you know, I'm sure told to me with loving intent to protect me from a horrific past. I'm absolutely convinced of that. And yet, tragically, it didn't have that effect.
Right.
And so it took noticing, for example, to get back to your question, how fearful I was, even as a very young child, like in grade two, wanting to, you know, boys wanting to play football, and I would, like, pass it up.
Just wanting to avoid conflict? Was that the fear?
That's definitely one of my fears. But anything to do with a sense of risk of injury or death.
Okay.
Or most especially premature death, and especially an unpleasant one, would be very challenging for me to deal with.
Got it. Wow. And so tell us some of those moments of coming to the awareness of this and that you could actually begin to heal.
Great question. So it didn't kind of come together in one big moment. It was a
right.
slow awakening. So moments of awakening include, for instance, noticing that other people are capable of watching television, television and movies that depicted scenes of violence where I had almost no ability to observe such scenes.
Wow.
The fear that I reported, like, you know, as early as grade two or so about, you know, not wanting to play football for fear of being injured was another such example. And then noticing how, much later on, how certain parts of the history of World War II that touch onto my family really stirred a lot of feeling, a lot of distress in me. Even as a young adult, middle-aged adult, that was actually the first kind of more concrete clue, I think I still have some wounds or trauma from this event. But it was, you know, initially really puzzling. Well, it happened 20 years before I was born. How could it be affecting me? And I kind of denied what I was actually experiencing, unfortunately. And yet, I think, you know, I can't speak to the mechanism of transmission at the purely physical or biological level. I do know that I was an ovum in my mother's ovary in 1938 when her family fled Austria. That much is indisputable.
Mm-hmm.
Everything else is probably subject to complicated debate. I'm not sure that's quite the direction we want.
Right, right. So at some point, after some counseling and, you know, other experiences, you got introduced to something called nonviolent communication, which some of our listeners may be familiar with. And there was a moment of understanding that it's through the difficult emotions that we find guidance. Maybe share a little bit about that, because I think that's something a lot of people can relate to.
So I have a bit of a different take on this than some number of people. I mean, a lot of people say, well, there's nothing to fear but fear itself, or some such message. I think an American president said that, and it's a kind of New Age kind of thing.
Right.
For me, it's more like following nonviolent communication. Our feelings are understood to be messages or signposts, and simplifying in nonviolent communication, they're often signposts to needs, often unmet needs that
right.
we carry in that moment. And so while I would often experience fear, I did notice time and time again that the level of fear that I was feeling was much greater than the other people around me in the same situation or facing the same choice or whatever it would be. And that pattern helped me to see, maybe what I'm actually fearing is not present here in the moment, but is actually something from the past as one piece. But as another, it's just, to me, it's clarifying to really understand which of my needs are met or unmet in any given moment, and to start from that as a basis for conversation. Because if two people are in the same situation, one person has one feeling and another has another, neither feeling's right, neither feeling's wrong. But where do you go?
Right.
What do you do to work through that? And what I love about nonviolent communication is it gives an understanding of where what's really alive in the moment, and therefore opens the doors to perhaps different strategies for dealing with the two different feelings of the two people involved.
So the negative emotions that we experience, which we often make ourselves wrong for and try to suppress and all of that, if we actually go into them a little bit more and try to understand what we're needing in that moment, there's a lot of guidance there. Is that what you experience?
Very, very much so.
Yeah.
Very fruitfully. And I'm not aligned with the framing of a negative emotion.
Right.
I would say
just
an emotion that arises from an unmet need
what we've become enculturated to think of as negative, right?
Yeah, but they're messengers nevertheless.
Right.
And even if the feeling is uncomfortable, or even if the need is like not so comfortable to look at, I think like others who've worked with nonviolent communication, I've experienced how pain or fear or grief or loss or other such emotions are easier to be with and to be present to if one also carries with that at the same moment an understanding of the need or needs that give rise to that emotion.
Mm.
Marshall's wonderful phrase was to talk about a sweet pain.
Feeling
the pain, but a sweet pain,
right.
Yes. You feel the pain, but you're also, and also you're aware of the need or needs that give rise to that pain. And the pain is more easily borne,
right,
in the presence of the awareness of those needs.
Yeah. And this brings up sort of the need for, you know, when embarking on the path of self-awareness and healing and growth, the accompanying need for big doses of self-compassion and empathy. Mm-hmm. And you had shared with me that that's something that has been very helpful for you in the process, as I've experienced as well. I think many others.
Absolutely. I think that was huge for me in beginning to face what understandably was not much faced in my grandparents' generation, my mom's generation, but gave me a tool and or skill to face in my generation, because otherwise it's too easy to get completely overwhelmed or completely lost in pain, fear, grief, horror, terror, whatever.
Right. And it also feels like we've been a bit misled around this process of personal evolution, that, you know, somehow pain that we might experience along the way, you know, is something we have a lot of judgment about. And we, you know, as you were saying, you know, oh, there's nothing to fear and blah, blah, blah. But the process actually is inherently painful to look at our own shadows and the places where we don't like what we see in ourselves sometimes. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, I there was a big part of me, probably my ego, which was an all too happy to not discover that there were unhealed wounds or trauma from previous generations, and that I could simply carry on having, you know, a life without that burden, legacy, inheritance, or whatever you would like to call that. Mm.
Right.
And I tried avoiding it and I tried denying it, but it kept showing up in a variety of situations. And noticing how choices that others could make with ease were choices that stirred, you know, scarcely manageable levels of fear in me, I started to see, oh my goodness, this is really holding me back from all kinds of things, personally, in my working life and elsewhere, you know, primary relationship. And I really started to see slowly and with difficulty over a long period of time, my goodness, is a real cap on the quality of my life, my lived experience, until I deal with this.
Right. Feels like so often whatever the forces are that are at play kind of up the ante with us and will make things painful until we're ready to kind of say, okay, I will take this on. I don't want this pain anymore.
My kind of quick take on that is that, you know, whatever issues one carries, opportunities are presented to work through that. And if one doesn't take those opportunities up, still more challenging ones will likely be dealt up with sooner or later. And, you know, what one resists persists. It doesn't go away, or to look at it differently, maybe, you know, there are some ways to make it, force it to kind of go away that involve, you know, substances and whatever.
Right.
But those two have their own high cost, I believe, in the quality of lived experience, too.
Well, let's take a quick pause here. This is Gwen Garcelon, and you're listening to The Inner Game on KD&K. My guest today is Brad Jarvis, and we're talking about the necessity of today's leaders to heal their own wounds and to own their shadows in order to bring forth an evolved world, which seems to be the motivation behind the Inner Activist program. And maybe share with us a little bit about that program and how it has evolved since 2006 when you started it.
Sure. So maybe just to state or restate, I'm not sure, the kind of connection. I through the experiences that my mom's branch of the family had and their response to it, reaction to it, I did not have much emotional awareness, and I hadn't healed from the wounds of that past. And so, just like we were talking about before the brief break, where I now find myself is in a founder of a project that offers, on the one hand, personal awareness training, but perhaps a bit more germane to both those times and these times, is training around diversity, equity, and inclusion, because 80 years ago in Austria, that's my family was on the unfair end of the stick, as it were.
Right.
And those issues of diversity, equity, inclusion haven't disappeared, and indeed, in some ways, they seem to be reasserting themselves in these times.
Yep.
And so that actually is really quite significant, because even though the Inner Activist Project is only 12 years old, we have been through a number of iterations, and we are indeed in the midst of still another reworking of our vision and mission and value statements and other core documents, and re-examining what kinds of curriculum we'll be delivering and by whom and with what intent or intents. And it's an ongoing process, in part because the times are changing, in part because our understanding of what the issues are at this deep level and how they're connected continues to evolve. Mm-hmm. And of course, we're not in a vacuum. Other people are looking at these issues of diversity, equity, and inclusion on the one hand, and personal awareness, personal consciousness on the other. And thankfully, I think in the 12 years since we started, more and more people are seeing more and more of the connections, because tragically, it's not just mainstream society, but also change makers themselves who are at risk of repeating some past trauma or pain or a wound if they aren't well into their healing of it and aware of what that wound is.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's to me, it's like I don't know quite what the expression is, you know, what thoughts for the gander, sauce for the goose kind of piece.
Mm-hmm. And I love the example that you shared with me of observing the peace movement as even as a boy, and mm-hmm. and really understanding that, man, we cannot create peace from anger. Maybe share that a little bit more of that observation as you unpacked it.
Sure. So at the time, I was approximately 10 years old in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, reading a daily paper that, you know, covered, among other things that were in Canada at that time, protests against the Vietnam War, despite Canada not being involved in the war.
Mm-hmm.
And I can to this day recall my visceral reaction of pulling back from what was reported. Now, I'm sure there's some biases in how it was reported, but the piece that I was pulling back and was in reaction to was the language of anger, the energy of anger that really came through even in the newspaper report. And the anger, quite frankly, scared me. And yet, how tragic, because my family, and by no means alone, many families in Canada at that time, 68, say, had been touched by war, and painfully so, and how life-affirming, life-enhancing it would have been for me to been supportive of the peace movement and to perhaps even participate in the peace movement. But my reaction was dramatically the opposite, to pull away, even though it could have been in a different formulation, both healing for me personally to participate in the creation of more peace in the world in the 1960s, mm-hmm. as well as perhaps in some tiny, indetectable way, contributed to greater peacefulness in the world as a whole in 1968 or so.
And yet you were turned off by the just the feelings of and the mm-hmm. sensing into the anger and conflict mm-hmm. in the movement. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And now we see, you know, some evolution of that, I think, with organizations like the Peace Alliance. And you know, there's just much more starting to be anyway. More understanding that we need to be peaceful in our creation of peace, and be mindful of those strong tendencies toward conflict.
Almost, I am not quite agreeing with your use of the word conflict, because, you know, consciously conducted conflict in the sense, in that widest sense of one person disagreeing with another, is something that's, I think, just part of the fabric of human life.
Right.
Unless you're a hermit. But sort of unconscious, you know, one sort of psychological phenomenon that plays out very tragically at the political or societal level is one person or group is unaware of a certain tendency or desire that they carry. So they project it onto another group and to try to other that group, or still worse, make that group into some kind of enemy, because they are somehow characterized as being the carrier of that trait or tendency or whatever it may be. And that's a recipe for unconscious conflict and needless casualties of all kinds on both sides.
Brad, what's a personal practice or a skill that has helped you in that area yourself?
Well, I'm actually going to come back to self-empathy. You know, I might well have turned out to be one seriously angry young white man, had things not played out differently. Some of that has to do with other influences from my family, etc. But self-empathy, as understood through nonviolent communication, has helped me to heal many wounds that I carried, helped me to be conscious when I would not have otherwise been so, helped me to carry on through very difficult times without falling apart, and hopefully helped me to contribute less unconscious conflict into the world as well.
Right. And is that...
Contribute would not be the right word.
What are some ways in your program that self-empathy, self-compassion can be learned and nurtured?
Well, we have, for instance, courtesy of one of our one-time facilitators, who's unfortunately not any longer involved for health reasons, an incredible, it's simply an 8.5 by 11 with lists of feelings and lists of needs that really can help people who, for whatever reason, maybe they're highly distressed in a given moment, find, oh, this is the feeling, the exact feeling I'm having. Oh, this is the need or needs which are unmet in this moment. And to, you know, even if they don't ever articulate that to anyone, they can still give themselves empathy and move back towards presence, you know, in the midst of a business meeting or a coalition meeting or a meeting with, you know, others in your own family or neighbor or whomever it might be. And it can make a huge difference, just, you know, a few minutes or moments even of processing, oh, this is really painful because it reminds me of my disconnection from someone I once loved, or, you know, wanting to be treated respectfully and caringly, and what I'm hearing are words of anger and judgment. Mm.
So it sounds like just even becoming aware that there's an option and understanding a little bit more about your personal process can be that tool that opens up a whole new way of being in those moments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's both. It's both a process that can shift how one feels without any change in the outside world.
Right.
And by identifying needs and thereby kind of being an opening to different strategies, it can actually furthermore make a change in the outside world. If you can get, say you're in conflict with one of the persons, and the person to agree to, hey, there's this other strategy for meeting your needs and mine. Let's go, how are we about that? Mm.
Well, I think we're going to have a second conversation, Brad, because there's all kinds of other things that I'd love to talk with you about. Maybe we can do a part
Great.
Two. But thank you so much for this conversation, and thanks to the listeners for being with us today. If you have a question for Brad or me, you could join the Facebook page at The Inner Game, and the page acts as a forum to continue these conversations, and you can find out where to listen to past shows as well. So until next time, don't be afraid to dive into your own personal journey. There are fruits and gifts that we are all waiting for you to gift to the world. So thank you so much.
Clouds are swift, rocks are ancient, mountains are high.